Kiss I Tell podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jonathan White. Jonathan's a professor of politics and deputy head of the European Institute at the LSE. But more importantly for today, he's the author of In the Long Run, The Future as a Political Idea, a new book which came out in February earlier this year. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
So can we just start by asking a little bit about what the motivation was for writing this book, which focuses particularly on the sort of notion of the future and how that's shaping contemporary democracy?
Yes, certainly. So I've long had an interest in time and politics and emergencies in politics, which I think are often all to do with time and the acceleration of time and the way in which the experience of acceleration can shape politics, can shape the kind of policies that perhaps seem appropriate, but perhaps even more importantly, can shape who seems like they ought to be in control. So a standard argument from the history of thinking about emergencies is that when time is short, then you don't really have time for deliberation, for disagreement, for contestation. On the contrary, you should shift power to those who can act quickly, think in a single voice, and so on. So coming from a background of thinking about how certain experiences of accelerated time can be difficult for democracy, I then got into thinking also about how ideas of the future and the sense in which the expectation of what lies ahead could perhaps perform a similar kind of function in making both certain kind of policies seem appropriate, but also certain kind of transfers of power or certain ways of thinking about how power is exercised, whether more in terms of deliberation and ideas or whether more in terms of personalities and heroes and individuals. So it was a continuation of a wider stream of thought about the place of time in politics.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One of the things that struck me in the book is the way in which we often think that optimism about the future helped to drive democracy. But it seems to you that, and I quote, the future no longer seems to be democracy's friend. And I was quite intrigued by what you meant by that.
On the one hand, I think you're quite right to suggest that democracy as a modern phenomenon, as a representative democracy, that which we've had for around a couple of 100 years, I guess, although whether we've ever had real democracy in that period is itself a debate. But certainly, I think it's fair to say that the process of democratization is one that has often been inspired by possibly optimism, but not just optimism. When it's inspired by fears, perhaps by a sense that there is enough time to change structures, to deal with the problems that cause those fears, that even if things are bad, there's time enough to overcome the things that undermine democracy, whether that's to do with concentrations of economic power, whether it's to do with imperfect institutions. Representation is, of course, a difficult thing. It's very hard to represent interests, values without excluding others. And there's a sense, therefore, in which I think modern representative democracy has always had to cope with this sense that it's pretty imperfect. It never quite seems to do what it's meant to do. And so even when people perhaps were pessimistic about the state of institutions, of politics, of distributions of power in the present, that sense of the ample future, if you like, that there's time enough to come, is a way of coping with those problems and saying, well, maybe either the next election things can be made better, or if not the next election, many elections into the future, that there is a longer process of tackling distributions of power, obstacles to democracy, that can make democracy plausible. And my organising idea, I guess, for this book is that perhaps we live in an age where that confidence, if not optimism, but that confidence in the availability of time, the time for correcting mistakes or correcting fundamental injustices, I think to many people no longer seems to be available, whether we're thinking about climate change and the deadlines associated with that, or whether we're thinking about concentrations of power under capitalism that seem to become ever more difficult, ever more intractable, because they are somehow escalating. And that sense of the irreversibility of contemporary political trends, I think, is pronounced across a wide range of domains. So that's the sense in which I guess the book starts from some sense of the specificity of the present. It's that sense of the curtailed future, the foreshortened future, which I think is quite significant for a lot of contemporary politics.
When we think about that sort of shortened future, you write a bit about what we might think of as a sort of constant state of emergency, the fact that perhaps we don't have enough time to deal with some of these issues, and how that isn't very conducive to sort of getting around short-term thinking, and it leads to a more kind of reactive style of politics. I was just wondering how unusual you thought a sort of perpetual state of crisis was in political terms. Or put another way, you know, have there been times when democracies haven't been driven by more kind of short-termist political thinking?
I think there is a compelling argument one can make that that the present period is, if not simply like any other period, somehow anticipated in many other periods, that the sense of emergency around climate change is somehow foreshadowed by ideas of emergency around the atomic bomb, for example, in the mid-20th century, or indeed that a lot of the socialist politics of the late 19th, early 20th century is inspired by a certain sense that kind of capitalism itself is either an emergency or is in a kind of emergency that allows some kind of decisive intervention. So clearly one can make the case that emergency thinking is something that is a perennial aspect of politics. I think what I'm interested in primarily, of course, is perceptions here. In other words, the sense that we live in an age not just of any one kind of dominating emergency, but the emergency is everywhere we look. We have new words like polycrisis to capture this idea that wherever you train your eyes in the present, you're going to come across something that seems to be on the verge of breakdown, or at least requiring some type of decisive act. And I think it's that sense of the, if you like, the proliferation of perceptions of emergency and claims to emergency across a wide range of fields, from geopolitics to economics to the climate and so on, which perhaps is a little bit different about the present. So, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that we should be very cautious in announcing the novelty of the 21st century in this respect. But I do think, at least at the level of perceptions, we live in an age which is widely felt to be one of not just a particular emergency in a field of foreign policy or a particular emergency in the field of the economy, but the intersection of emergencies across the whole range of political questions. And I think linguistic innovation like polycrisis captures that thought.
And how much do you think that sort of sense of like a multifaceted set of crises or emergencies is a characteristic of what you might think of as old democracies or states in the global north? Or how much is it kind of more wide ranging geographically, globally, across different types of democracy?
I think to some extent it is something one can localize, partly because, of course, if we go down the route of what I was saying a moment ago, that, you know, there are emergencies that are always part of politics. And of course, in some parts of the world, that sense of emergency may also have been especially pronounced in other periods. So, you know, the experience of colonization is for many an experience of, well, some have written about this as kind of the apocalypse that's already happened, as opposed to the apocalypse to come. And therefore that in some parts of the world, this notion of living with a sense of impending catastrophe is quite distinctively Western, because in other places it's not an impending catastrophe, it's something that is an established fact. And that's not just a point that one can make about colonization, but it's clearly one way in which that point has often been expressed. So then picking up on the point about specifically democracy, I think there's a sense in which some of this anxiety of the present in Western democracies is somehow connected to a sense that democracy was achieved, and not just democracy, but that sort of welfare states were achieved. There's almost a kind of complacency that goes with it. You fear the loss of things when you believe that you actually had them. And that, again, is something which is probably very much possible to localise in time and place. And those parts of the world which have perhaps maybe more clear-eyed doubted that either their own political systems or indeed those of the West were ever democratic, were ever stably economically developed, that to the extent that one doubts these things, then clearly the shock of volatility, of upheaval, is diminished by that. So there's a certain complacency that goes with the idea that this is an age of breakdown, because it presupposes that something was achieved. And as a critical scholar, I guess I would say, yeah, there's every reason to doubt that democracy was achieved, every reason to doubt that the modern political economy was a stable thing, even in the European welfare state, the place so often idealised as such. But again, at the level of perceptions, I think these were felt perceptions, certainly after the Cold War in the 90s into the early 2000s. And there's that confrontation between the experience of upheaval, of breakdown, with that sense that progress had been made, which is the source of anxiety.
And I guess another way of thinking about that complacency and how it might be challenged is around questions of kind of intergenerational approaches to this, and particularly sitting in the UK, ideas around kind of intergenerational equity are really rising up the agenda. Do we cut taxes now and have a trade-off in terms of sort of environmental policy for the future, for example? How do you think your arguments sit alongside those concerns around intergenerational equity within modern democracy?
Yeah, so I guess this is one of the key idioms in which concerns about the future tend to make their way, certainly into contemporary academic scholarship, but I think also to some degree public discourse or even public institutions. Generational accounting, of course, is one of the ways in which budgets are supposedly made more sensitive to these questions of the relationships and both of functionality and of ethical obligation across time. I think one feeling that I would have about a lot of this way of looking at it is it does somewhat depoliticize the future. It treats the idea of obligations across time as though one could somehow optimize it, as though one could identify the interests of future generations in almost as a scientific matter rather than as a matter of democratic contestation, and that one can therefore think about optimal distributions either of debts across time, of productivity across time, that if one does the maths correctly, then somehow one can yield public policy from that. And I find that somewhat a misconception of how to think about the future, how to think about the obligations of the present to the future. It's not a profound thought, but there are clearly many possible futures available in principle. There are many types of obligation across time based on how you define what is valuable, based on how you see the options for making changes in the present. And these are all questions of disagreement. This is why I think the future needs to be an object for democracies, whereas often when people think about intergenerational obligation, I think they often end up with a slightly more technocratic way of seeing the politics of time as a matter of setting aside resources for something called future generations, as though they had singular interest, as though they were not internally divisible, as though it were not important to distinguish, you know, the future generations of the global north from the global south, the future generations of middle and upper classes from the future generations of the global poor, and so on. So there are many future people out there, without going into some of the big philosophical questions about population ethics. There are many different types of interest out there in the future. And sometimes I worry that talking about obligations to future generations somewhat underplays all those aspects and takes something that's quite democratic into a direction that's much more technocratic.
That's really interesting. And one of the other themes that runs through the book that I found fascinating was the impact and influence of the changing nature of technology across time. How do you understand that relationship between technology and democracy?
One of the chapters of the book is interested in questions of secrecy, which is perhaps where some of these questions of technology become politically quite significant. So I think in some periods, technology has been a source of optimism about the future, or indeed a sense almost of the confirmation of progress, that onto which we can latch if we want to have confirmation that societies are heading in something like a desirable direction. This is clearly an enlightened way in which technology has often been thought about. But of course, that way of thinking about technology perhaps has certain preconditions. It requires us perhaps to think of technology as something that is accessible to public scrutiny so that we can, you know, make that assessment about, is it good for society or does it have nefarious side effects that we need to worry about? And I think, and you know, many people might start this story with atomic weapons, but I think you can start it with many of the military technologies of the 20th century especially. You get an increasing suspicion of technology, which I think is founded very much in the sense that it's opaque, that its full effects cannot be gauged, that something is being kept behind our capacity to scrutinize it. So clearly in the context of the Cold War, that applies to how new technologies of military deterrence are applied, but also, and here my interest in the future comes through, in how predictions are made about military adversaries, about how to control populations at home by sort of feeding them predictions, feeding them selected accounts of intelligence that gives them some inkling of what the future might include in geopolitics, but also screening out other kinds of concern. And once you start to get that veiling of technology and of the social relations in which it is developed and exercised, then I think that becomes also the basis for conspiracy theories. People start to think that, you know, what is it that I'm not seeing here? What is it that's behind the curtain? And technology then moves from being, if you like, that marker of aspirations of societal progress towards something more like a kind of a yardstick by which one sees how far representatives are actually detached from those they are meant to represent, how far mistrust starts to creep in into their interrelations. So I think technology is interesting there as something that can either reinforce optimism about the future, but to the extent that it's something transparent, public, to the extent to which it is seen as something open to scrutiny. And once it moves away from that model, then away from ideas of transparency, it becomes the mark of its opposite. And I think that feeds, as I say, into contemporary politics in the form of mistrust, of conspiracy theories and so on.
Hello, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to remind you to sign up to the UK in a Changing Europe newsletter, which comes out every week, featuring our latest research and news about our exciting range of events. Subscribe now on our website. And just thinking a little bit more about that question of kind of trust in politics, you know, do you think current electorates feel disempowered in terms of their democracies? And if so, how might a sort of greater attention to the future help restore confidence in politics and the democratic process?
So my suspicion is that this sense of overriding emergency that we were talking about a moment ago does have one of its sources precisely in that sense of mistrust and indeed of political helplessness, a sense of powerlessness that I think many people, certainly many citizens, but also even many representatives and policy makers in the present perhaps feel. So I guess the guiding thought there would be that on the one hand, while we might think of emergencies as sort of simply the expression of material problems, which at some level they are, problems of climate, problems of economic inequality, at the same time, things become an emergency when you feel you can't really respond to them. Because the problems of climate change, we know roughly what has to be done. It's not like it's a question of ignorance and the anxiety that comes with ignorance, with not knowing what you're meant to do. Likewise, with many problems of contemporary capitalism, I think it's not a problem of knowledge; it's a problem of agency. So things become emergencies precisely to the extent that you feel that they're very hard to deal with. That you don't have agents in politics that you trust to somehow act in the way that you feel is necessary to responding to them. So, in answer to your question, yes, I think many people in contemporary politics, at the level of citizens, at the level of policymakers, exactly feel that sense of waning connection and almost fatalism. The politics of emergency is an expression of exactly that feeling. In some of my previous work, I've been interested in political parties and indeed the idea of a party, what it is to conceptualize a party. And I think one way to think of what a party is, if you like, kind of organized thinking about the future. It's an entity, an organization that is meant to endure. It's meant to be a cause that perhaps outlives the individual lifespan, something that you can perhaps contribute to or track the fortunes of and give your allegiance to, but something that ideally continues some project beyond the here and now into the future. And therefore, you don't expect it to, you don't expect equality to be achieved in any meaningful sense within the electoral cycle, or indeed within two electoral cycles. It's a kind of continuous project, an ongoing project. And I think that historically, it's the existence of exactly these types of collectives in politics that can give a kind of confidence in the future and a sense of that amplitude of the future that I referred to before. These entities emerge in the 19th century very much in tandem with those ideas of the extended future that I track at the beginning of the book. And I think at the same time, just as they rise together, perhaps they fall together. The story of the 20th century in terms of party politics, I think, is easy to tell as a story of not the disappearance of parties, but the weakening of the sense in which they represent an enduring cause, the extent to which they define themselves by an open-ended politics of ideas rather than particular targets, particular qualities of competence that might be expressed by individuals. Think about how the current Labour Party tends to express itself less in terms of an ism like socialism and much more in terms of the competence of its leader as the leadership would like to present it. So that change in what a party is in terms of its self-image and its presentation to the wider population in so many countries, I think, has to be understood as something that feeds into that sense of emergency, that sense of the overwhelming claims of the present rather than of the further future on our attention. When you lack those agents that you can identify and somehow attach hopes for the further future to, then it all becomes the politics of emergency. It all becomes about trying to resolve things in the now.
And I guess another way in which states have sort of tried to deal with questions of emergency and emergencies that are developing is through direct democracy. We're quite familiar with this in the UK following the Brexit referendum, for example. In the book, there seems to be a degree of scepticism on the role of these forms of direct democracy. And I just wondered why that was and what your thinkings were on those types of democracy and their relationship to the future.
Yes, I think that is exactly a fair reflection of how I see it. So I wrote this book in awareness that many people would perhaps say that surely it's representative democracy that has a problem of thinking about the future, and maybe other forms of democracy are therefore the answer. So the idea that representative democracy has a problem with the future goes back a long way. Someone like Tocqueville at the beginning of the 19th century is already writing about what he fears is the impatience of public opinion, the desire for immediate gratification or a kind of intolerance of longer-term hardship. He's comparing this to aristocracies, monarchies, other forms of politics that he feels are better able to attune themselves to the interests of their polities. And then, of course, this becomes a theme in political science, especially in the 20th century into the 21st century, that perhaps not just that public opinion is myopic, but also the institutions of representative democracy are things that incentivize a kind of short-termism amongst representatives. So they incentivize caring only about the next election, caring about devoting yourself to those things that can be completed within a five-year cycle. If that's the perspective one has of representative democracy, then clearly one might say, well, what about forms of democracy that are not based on periodicity in this fashion, that are not based on the incentives of re-election that seem to shape so much of representative democracy? And here many people might advocate exactly randomly selected juries of citizens, assemblies of people picked at random precisely to remove those kind of incentives to think about things in a certain way. Randomness precisely invites people not to be strategic in how they approach politics, because they don't know what's coming. They can't assume that anything they do now is going to lead to their re-election, their continued power, their exit from power. They just see things as they see them and make suggestions accordingly. So direct democracy, by decoupling politics from institutions and their cycles, is advocated by many as the answer here. My scepticism that you flagged up, I think, is maybe twofold. On the one hand, a sense that maybe representative democracy has distinctive qualities that are too overlooked in that account, and conversely, that the appeal of direct democracy may be overstated in these terms. On the latter point, it seems to me that randomly selected assemblies of ordinary people may indeed have that desirable quality of, you know, blue skies thinking, of thinking about politics without strategic considerations. But every time you convene such assembly and then terminate it and maybe convene another one, you're likely to get different opinions being raised. These are conducive to will formation within the duration of a certain assembly, but nothing really guarantees the cumulative aspect of politics, that opinion formed in one assembly can be carried forward to the next. And so it seems to me that, you know, the real danger is there. You get a kind of a series of long, ideally long-termist perspectives that don't accumulate, that don't add up to anything more than that, a series of kind of sparks of long-termism, but without anything to link them, without the cause, without the organisation that I was referring to a moment with the party. And then, so if that's the kind of the note of scepticism about direct democracy, then the note of optimism about representative democracy would be to say that many of the problems that we perhaps identify in contemporary political parties, this tendency to prioritise strategic thinking over thinking of principle, I think it's got a lot to do with where power lies within these agents. Who has power within a party? People who are political activists, or indeed people who support parties and get occasionally involved with them. These are often people for whom the politics of ideas is everything. They're in it for the cause. They're in it for some idea that they are concerned about, I don't know, long-term environmentalist questions, socialist projects before, during and after the revolution and so on, or social democratic ones that have no particular attachment to ideas of interruption and revolution, but sort of the incremental long-term project. These are an element of, I think, many contemporary parties still. And so if it's something that we easily overlook, it's because parties are often not very internally democratic. They're often dominated by a leadership class which is much more interested in the strategic aspects of re-election and so on. And so, you know, clearly there are many huge obstacles to democratizing political parties, and it may be that it's too late for many existing parties. Maybe we're talking about, rather, are there is there scope for the emergence of new parties? Can new collectives of this kind be founded on a different footing? But it seems to me that there is scope for representative democracy to be less short-termist than we tend to accuse it of. And conversely, that direct democracy, although it seems to have a intuitive appeal in this regard, there's a danger that you don't get that kind of the joining of the dots, the adding up of a series of moments of blue skies thinking, of big questions of principle being connected from the past, the present, to the future by some kind of organisation that can carry forward these hopes, these proposals across time, rather than just make them a series of forgettable proposals. And in that's, of course, how they're often used. You convene an assembly, let it speak, then disband it, away it goes, and the mark it's left on politics is rather ephemeral.
And just thinking about that kind of more long-term thinking, if you like, what do you think the key messages are from your book for current and particularly future generations about the nature of democracy?
Well, I guess if I was to synthesize it down to a simple point, I think very often people make the argument that we should think long term, that we should lift our eyes from the emergencies day to day and you know, take a 10-year perspective, take a 15-year perspective, or with climate deadlines, look at 2050 or something. And I mean, there's much to be said for that kind of argument, but it seems to me that it's not just a question of kind of the psychological injunction to lift your eyes. It's about creating institutions, organizations that give credibility to exactly those longer horizons. And until you have parties which are set up to be that, or political movements, and it can also be, you know, social collectives, something like the debt collective, something which is set up not to contest parliamentary power, but set up as a kind of enduring cause within civil society, set up to exactly to aggregate power beyond individuals at a particular moment. This is, again, or trade unions, likewise. Trade unions are, I think, organisations intended to endure, intended to outlive the time span of members at a particular moment, precisely to better look after their interest in the long term. If you don't have these, if you like, agents of the longer perspective, if you just turn it into a psychological injunction to care about the world in 10, 20, 30 years' time, I don't think you're going to make sufficient progress. So to that extent, I think my message is think about the politics of the long-term perspective and not just think about the psychology of the long-term perspective. And maybe as a footnote to that, I mean, I think we should always also ask ourselves, is a long-term perspective always better than a short-term perspective? There may be contexts in which, the climate one is clearly one, in which urgency is perhaps an entirely appropriate spirit in which to think about a certain set of problems. It seems to me that maybe it's worth distinguishing between the urgency of beginnings, the urgency of endings. So climate deadlines obviously invite us to think about acting quickly, but also often with the idea of a critical window after which either it's too late and one's missed the boat, or hopefully you're in some new type of scenario, a transition has been made to a fundamentally different scenario. And I think it's that latter one that I think is perhaps more suspect, and the reason why you need these enduring agents of politics like parties, unions, other collectives is because although there are problems where we need to maybe get started urgently, those are not necessarily ones where we can expect to complete a set of tasks in anything like a short-term perspective. Climate change will continue to raise problems well beyond 2030. Other environmental problems to do with biodiversity and so on will also be present well beyond those most immediate deadlines. So one has to, I think about the agents that can connect the present to those more distant horizons rather than talk the language of climate transition, for example, which perhaps promises calm waters on the other side of a stormy interlude.
Thanks, Jonathan. And thank you for giving up the time to talk about your new book today. There's certainly lots for us to get thinking about. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.